Hi, my name is Corvin Russell, and this is an occasional podcast from the Socialist Project. Today we'll be talking about the increasingly dire situation in Bolivia, where a military coup has installed a right-wing dictatorship that has curtailed constitutional freedoms and is engaging in widespread, brutal repression. This turn of events follows attempts by President Evo Morales and the democratically elected government of the Movimiento al Socialismo, or MAS, to rewrite the Constitution to enable Morales to seek a fourth term in office. This was rejected in a referendum, but the results of the referendum were controversially overturned by the country's Supreme Court. Following this, opposition parties who ran against Morales in the recent presidential election pledged not to honor the results of the vote if Morales won, whether fairly or not. During this time, right-wing forces representing wealthy elites in larger cities, particularly in the east of the country, began organizing against the government, most prominently the Santa Cruz Civic Organization led by businessman Luis Fernando Camacho, who was associated with a fascist political group. Although no evidence of fraud was ever furnished, accusations of irregularities followed the October 20th election, in which Morales was the undisputed frontrunner. In response, a broad range of social actors took to the streets. Eventually, police forces rebelled, and after 3 days, the military asked Morales to step down on November 10th, even though his current term does not end until January 21st. Representatives of the MAS, who still hold substantial and undisputed majorities in both houses of parliament, were barred from entering the legislature, and Jeanine Añez, second vice president of the Senate, who has a history of white supremacist views, declared herself president in front of an empty chamber. This past Friday, November 22nd, I discussed the situation in Bolivia with Catherine Lederer and Brett Gustafson to get a better understanding of the background to the coup. We spoke to Catherine from Cochabamba, Bolivia, where she's lived for 29 years. Catherine is director of the Andean Information Network, which does analysis of political issues, human rights, and drug policy. Brett is associate professor of anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and has been doing research on Bolivia since 1992. We reached him in Vancouver. We did try to get in touch with representatives of the MAS, but due to the extreme repression and violence they're facing, most have been forced offline, and we were unable to reach any of them. Hi, Catherine and Brett. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having us.
Great. Thank you.
Catherine, you are in Cochabamba now, so maybe we can start with you. And I wonder if you'd be able to give us a bit of an introduction to the events that have led up to the coup and maybe some of the events that have happened recently. I know there have been a series of massacres.
Sure. Let me get started, and then I'm sure Brett will have a lot to add. There was an objection on the part of the Bolivian opposition about the results of the October 20th election. They claimed quite aggressively that there was widespread fraud. In response, the Morales administration, who had won a sufficient percentage by a hair to win in the first round of the election, something not so different than the poll results, proposed an audit by the Organization of American States and with oversight by other international organizations. The opposition chose not to participate in this, ratcheted up violence. There was a great deal of friction. Cities were blockaded in wealthier urban areas, rural areas. There were protests against this and a spiraling sense of violence. Well, not a sense of violence, genuine violence, as a right that had presented itself initially as very centrist began moving further and further and further to an extreme position, to a position where the spokesperson was Luis Fernando Camacho of the pro-Santa Cruz Civic Committee. And I think Brett will have a better background information on that organization. But as violence increased and the pressure on the part of the opposition groups increased, the OAS speedily released the results at 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning, almost 2 weeks ago. And Morales, who had agreed that the audit would be binding, immediately called for new elections and for a multi-party dialogue to elect a new electoral tribunal. It's interesting to note that although this had been the key demand at that time for the opposition, they continued to pressure, demanded his resignation, and groups began to attack Hamas officials' homes, burn them, attack their relatives. It was very terrifying that, you know, Hamas officials' home addresses and electronic locations were distributed massively over the internet. And Morales, after a great deal of pressure and concern about the violence, and after the Bolivian Armed Forces unconstitutionally suggested he resign, did resign, and yet the violence has continued, the polarization has continued, and the armed forces have gone out onto the streets. And with the presence of the armed forces, it's important to note that the Morales administration had only sent the police out. The police did not use lethal ammunition. And immediately with this self-proclaimed coup government, we see the armed forces on the streets, we see the bullets flying, and we see the bodies pile up.
The Organization of American States, as I understand it, never actually furnished evidence of fraud. They said there were questions about the security provisions that had been made during the election. They never disputed. In fact, no one's ever disputed that Morales was actually in the lead and had the most votes. Is that right?
I don't think anyone disputes that Morales had the most votes. I think that was quite clear. The Organization of the American States has said many things at many different times. Their initial report that was hastily done, and it's only preliminary and only in Spanish, suggests problems with changes in computer servers. It's pretty important, I think, to note that this initial count, the TREP, was funded by the European Union. They hired outside consultants to do all of the computing. So I don't think you can point to direct Morales intervention in the initial count. They also cited some irregularities in voting rolls, but we've never seen the full report. External auditors have suggested that these are all clarified, or for the most part clarified with corrections in writing. We just don't have enough information to know exactly what the result was, how it was carried out. It was certainly the results were rushed and turned in early. And as Brett has said, we may never know.
Well, Brett, maybe you can jump in at this point and fill in some of the details around, first of all, the difference between the early vote and the official vote, which I think may be unclear to most people, and maybe some of what Catherine was alluding to in terms of the role of some of the right-wing civic organizations.
Sure. I can't add too much to what Catherine said. It's a good description. So the preliminary vote counts were coming in the day of the election, and late that evening, that was shut off, and the system was switched over to the official count. And there was a time lag there, so that, of course, gave fodder to the opposition to cry foul before the final results even came in. And I should also say that many people on the opposition, despite the fact that they participated in the elections, it was pretty clear in the weeks leading up to the vote that many people in the opposition had already decided to protest, no matter what the outcome. If Evo won, with or without fraud, they were going to go into the streets. It was a predetermined plan to take to the streets. A lot of people are saying it was a spontaneous uprising. And certainly there are plenty of people on all sides of the political spectrum who are not satisfied with Evo Morales, did not want him to run for office again, and they want him out. So we have to make that clear. But the right now, in hindsight, we can see that this was deeply planned. You can't carry out what they managed to carry out in some spontaneous way. So, but anyway, back to the vote. After they shut off the preliminary count, they switched over to the official count, finished it off, and then Evo declared victory in the first round. By that time, people were in the streets. Fires were being started in some of the electoral offices. And why I say we may never know the outcome is because everyone in Bolivia votes on a paper ballot, but apparently many of those ballots were burned. So it will be hard to ever know.
And in the aftermath of the coup, it seems fairly clear that it's been right-wing forces almost exclusively who benefited from the coup and who are now occupying self-proclaimed positions of authority with the support of the military. But one of the narratives that's come out about the coup and the protests, about the protests leading up to the coup, is that there was a broad opposition to Morales, including from indigenous groups and social organizations on the left. So I'm wondering if one of you would like to speak to that in terms of the character of the opposition to Morales.
I can say a bit, sure. So I would say, yes, there was a broad spectrum of opposition to Morales, including some indigenous peoples and groups. There's also a broad spectrum of support for Morales. So, you know, at least 47%, give or take a few, voted for him. So the opposition against him comes from, first of all, people who may be sort of liberal or centrist and just oppose him staying in office. Many colleagues of mine who consider themselves to be left intellectuals also deeply opposed to his reelection. And then plenty of people in the middle class who had been sort of marginalized from their historic privileges to get jobs with the government and so forth had kind of thought it was time for him to leave and give other people a chance to come back to work. So there's what we might call a centrist opposition that included some left figures dissatisfied with the Morales government for many reasons. But at the end of the day, the right wing kind of overwhelmed that. And here I'd like to hear Catherine's perspective as well. The right wing, to my mind, took advantage of this broad popular discontent to work its way into power. And it wasn't just, you know, ordinary run-of-the-mill right wing. This is a right wing that has a long history of espousing what are clearly proto-fascist ways of speaking, racism, a very conservative Catholicism, a conservative fundamentalist Christianity, at least in speech, if not in practice. And that's what we're seeing in power right now.
Catherine, do you want to speak to that? And maybe address also the history of right-wing opposition, which, as I understand it, has been constant throughout Evo and the MAS's time in government.
Well, I agree with Brett's assessment completely. I think it's important to note that you have this concern about the fourth term and whether or not a fourth run for Morales is legitimate. But that doesn't necessarily mean the people concerned about the fourth term oppose or don't recognize Morales' achievements. And at this point in time, where the conflict has taken on a very, well, beginning with the blockades in the city, the very classist and racist focus, you know, many of those indigenous groups or many of the working class people who initially voted for, and I wouldn't say with great enthusiasm for Mesa, the second place candidate, it's, you know, an opposition that is unified in its hatred of Morales, but doesn't share a common platform or vision or really even a plan for how they're supposed to govern. But so the, you know, this group of people who may have been anti-Morales, it doesn't mean that they have signed up for what we're going through now, which is clearly a clue, which is where there are gross human rights violations, violations of freedom of expression, although it started in a very non-traditional way, people who worked in Bolivia for many years in other countries now can recognize all of the traditional signs of putting the squeeze on political opponents and other voices that speak out. And that middle class, I think it's important to note, one of the reasons that middle class public opinion, you haven't seen it shift, or you haven't seen or heard a greater outcry against this coup, is because alternative media outlets have been silenced during the beginning of the protests, community radio stations, union radio stations, media outlets that supported Morales were burnt down or sacked, the Coca Grower Radio, the state TV and newspaper were taken over. The radio frequency, for example, of the Coca Growers radio station and other radio stations have been eliminated. Telesur was just taken off the grid yesterday. And in this void, there are Bolivian press accounts that are completely inaccurate or often have a pro self-imposed government stance, but also a flurry of fake news and alarmist messages and often very racist messages on Facebook, on WhatsApp, that really flood the urban middle class population and others with a lot of information that provokes fear and impedes a clearer analysis of what actually is going on here.
Well, and a couple of things I'd like to follow up on there. As I understand it, while the MAS was in government, they never shut down oppositional right-wing media. And now we see, even though this coup has been lauded in some quarters in Western liberal democracies as a victory for democracy, shutting down the press certainly would speak against that. And another thing that I think you've mentioned elsewhere, Catherine, is that the cities have been actually closed off to indigenous protesters from the countryside who might otherwise have entered the city to protest. And so there's a kind of deceiving appearance of calm, which also might be accounting for the satisfaction of the middle classes that you just mentioned.
Yes, and about that, I can specifically speak about Cochabamba, where I am. This sense of calm really leads to a blockade or a police military barrier outside Cochabamba in the direction to the east. And beginning on Monday, they systematically began to stop every vehicle or anyone traveling from the region. Initially, this was quite violent, including a MAS congresswoman, where you're ordered out of the car at gunpoint, shoved up against the vehicle, handcuffed, your belongings searched, even inside your underwear, and been told to go back where you belong, that you're not welcome in the city. And this is, you know, now they're in the process of checking the ID cards and any people who are from the Chapari coca growing region, Evo Morales's home region, are not allowed into the city. It's kind of a quickie apartheid system that's very, very bizarre. And when I've complained about that to people in the cities, they also say, why would they need to come here? They need to stay where they belong. And it's a very racist, classist discourse, which had improved dramatically during Morales's tenure. That's not to say that Morales was perfect and that, you know, everything was a piece of cake, but there was greater respect for indigenous people, greater respect for diversity, greater inclusion. We don't see that now. In terms of right-wing press outlets, you know, in the first year or so of the Morales administration, there were a couple attempts to close a few radio stations that did not have their operating license in order. But that's something that, in my understanding, ended relatively early. And throughout Morales' administration, you had right-wing press and press attacks and, you know, freedom of the press in the sense that you could say anything you wanted about Morales and the government. And there were a few journalists that were initially or that were targeted in later years, but those cases were dropped. I didn't perceive that that was a Morales directive, but more an overzealous prosecutor in a region that then had to push back from an inappropriate and illegal stance.
Brett, I wonder if you might speak to the character of the right-wing opposition and particularly the role of Luis Fernando Camacho in the run-up to this coup. Who are they? And maybe a little bit expanding on the demographics, the social demographics of Bolivia that Catherine was just discussing. What percentage of the population is indigenous so that listeners can have a picture of what this kind of impromptu apartheid means?
Right. So figures are disputed, but between 50 to 60% of the country self-identify as belonging to one of 30, 32 different indigenous nations or peoples, they're called. The vast majority are Aymara, most of whom historically live around La Paz, but who now live all over the country, and Quechua, who historically live in the southern south of La Paz, but are now also all over the country in the cities. Being indigenous means a variety of different things. So for listeners, they shouldn't sort of lump indigenousness together into one single thing. Indigenous peoples are not some sort of stereotypical rural person. They're, as I say, of course, now one of them was in the office of the presidency for 14 years. So at any rate, the eastern part of Bolivia is in the lowlands, very different from the Andes, ecologically speaking. In the lowlands, the economy has been based primarily on cattle ranching and soy farming and gas and oil development. in the Andes, it's historically been based on agriculture as well, but also mining. So the eastern part of the country began to gain influence in the 60s with U.S. support, in the 70s with oil development and the rise of a dictator, Banzer, who came from the eastern city of Santa Cruz, controlled the country through the oil boom of the 70s. It was also a cocaine boom of the 70s. During that time, the dictatorship gave away a lot of land to cronies in the east, and a lot of that land was indigenous people's land. So you have vast, vast land holdings that are the basis of power of what we might call the Eastern Bolivian right-wing elite. This is sort of their foundation of existence, is control over land. And the racism that characterizes them is not unique to the to Santa Cruz or eastern Bolivia. There's racism throughout the country towards indigenous people. It comes from the colonial history of the country. But that adds to their very conservative view based in opposing La Paz. And as we see now, and we saw in the 70s with Banzer, trying to use their power to capture the state. And so That's what I can say about the Eastern Bolivian right wing. Camacho is the president of an organization called the Civic Committee of Santa Cruz. The Civic Committee is, they're elected among themselves. It's like a chamber of commerce. So representatives of the Lawyers Guild, the Doctors Guild, the Engineers Guild, the Architects Guild, the Cattle Ranchers Guild, the Soy Farmers Guild, the Chamber of National Industry. I think they have one representative from the Transport Union. And they have a non-voting representative, which is a local indigenous organization that has been somewhat co-opted. But basically, it's a chamber of commerce, and they get together every few years or so and elect a new president. It's invariably a cattle rancher or a doctor, or in the case of Camacho, I believe his current business is in the insurance industry, but historically, his family controlled a private natural gas utility. As an individual, as I said elsewhere, he's not all that impressive at all. Doesn't have any real deep history being involved in public politics. But what he has behind him is the wealth and power of this economic elite that I'm describing.
Okay, thank you, Brett. Maybe if we can turn to Catherine now. Catherine, you've lived in Cochabamba for 29 years, and so you've experienced life in Bolivia before the MAS's advent to government. I'm wondering if you could just speak, first of all, to what that was like, what the experience of life was for indigenous people in Bolivia at the time in terms of social conditions, and what changes the MAS brought about.
Well, from my perception, you know, before MAS came into power, it's very important to note that most people in Cochabamba spoke Quechua, but it was perceived as an embarrassment to speak the indigenous language. People would pretend they didn't speak it. It was almost a prerequisite for employment or for university engagement, although there were some notable exceptions, to change your dress or to no longer, in the case of women, wear a pollera and have long braids, which are associated in Cochabamba with Quechua culture. It was very difficult for indigenous people to go into government buildings, to go into a nice restaurant. It was not considered appropriate for them to make eye contact with other people. The employment opportunities were extremely limited. You had very low salaries for domestic workers who would often work a 7-day week or a 6.5-day week at a wage lower than a minimum wage. And I think during Morales's tenure, you see a lot of things change. One is a legal change. For example, all the indigenous languages in Bolivia, and there are 34 of them, I think, Brett will correct me if I'm wrong, are now official languages of the state. It's a requirement to speak one of these languages, or at least to have studied them, to have a state job. And you saw a discourse that promoted equality and inclusion, an anti-racism and discrimination law, which had to be broadcast and reinforced by all forms of media, although this caused an outcry initially. And you saw the inclusion of more indigenous people in the Bolivian Congress in percentage than any other country. gender parity laws that were implemented and really respected by the mosque leadership and respected by social movements. And so you've seen not only a dramatic situation in terms of an end of discrimination, of inclusion in educational processes and access in government employment, but also really an empowerment of rural women and social movement women. And those voices are very, very strong. A focus on land titling, which gives rural women priority, both single heads of household, but it also puts women first on land titles when they have a partner. You see a lot of measures, social welfare measures, state investment in rural areas and basic services with a lot of the income from hydrocarbons, where you see a dramatic reduction in poverty and extreme poverty, reductions in infant mortality and maternal death, nutrition levels improve, access to basic services improve. And this was made a very noticeable difference. I think that there's a misunderstanding on the part of some people that these improvements have meant that coca growers now are incredibly wealthy or live a life of luxury, or that somehow rural sectors or the sectors that received benefits from MAS were at the expense of wealthier sectors or urban sectors, because that's simply isn't the case. It was an expanding pie in terms of state income, and these traditionally neglected sectors received attention. And it's interesting to note that when I see this group come in, this right-wing group that's managing the government or pulling the scenes from behind, I remember them from the 90s. It's not a dramatically new group of people, although there are these new faces like Camacho, as Brett explained. But it's the same vision, the same structure, the same hypothesis of narco-terrorism, the same sloppy attacks and focuses. Their strategies haven't changed. And that means that they're coming into a country 14 years later and they have learned nothing in the process. And it's very interesting interviewing people after the massacre in Sakaba. It was 3 a.m. that night, and you know, someone said to us, they need to understand that all the rural indigenous people now know all the laws and we know what they're doing is wrong. It's not, the world isn't the way they think it is. And I think this was a very poignant comment and understanding that things are very different. I think it's important to note, though, that, you know, the right has taken power. It's not clear what's going to happen. It's not going to clear if there are going to be elections that are biased. But I do feel very strongly that if the right stays in control, that you will see within the next year or so a bounce back as inflation increases, as people's rights are dramatically reduced. And I think you're going to see a lot of that middle class that was anti-Morales in the protests flip. And I think that there's going to be in the next year or so a series of protests that are Chile style or Ecuador style, where there's a great deal of pressure on these neoliberal right-wing governments to step down. It's not as easy as they think it is.
Because they're going to have to roll back gains that people have made under the MAS government. Maybe actually, if we could just address perhaps some of the measures the right has been taking to attack the MAS leadership or the MAS's ability to organize. I understand the situation is quite dire. Can you speak to that a bit, Catherine?
Well, it's important to note that the social movement leaders that I know have all received death threats, repeated constant threats, often threats on WhatsApp with the name and the phone number of the person making the threat. There's no idea that there would be legal consequences for making those threats. I already talked about the media smothered. Social movement leaders and MAS Congress members have had their Facebook accounts blocked. You can see their pages, but they can't post on them or use Messenger. We've had serious threats and attacks against journalists, both foreign and national press. We have seen gross human rights violations. We have seen, without provocation, military and police forces firing live ammunition into crowds of protesters in the case of Sakaba. And in the case of Sencata and El Alto, is my understanding that they were unarmed. We personally carried out with the Harvard Human Rights Clinic an investigation the night of the massacre in Sacaba. They were unarmed, they were tear gassed, and then live ammunition was fired by the security forces, even from the air and helicopters. We have photographic evidence of this, and the head wounds of some of the nine dead show very clearly that they were shot from above. We're looking at nine people in Sacaba dead from bullet wounds, mostly to the head and to the heart. Over 100 wounded, many of them with severe bullet wounds, people attempting to assist other people being shot. A very, very clear vision of gross human rights violations, and a supreme decree backed up by another supreme decree providing additional emergency funding to the military that grants impunity for the security forces for any of these actions. And at the same time, it obligates all civilians and state institutions to cooperate with the armed forces and the police in this situation. That's not democracy. That's a dictatorship.
One more follow-up question I'd like to ask. You alluded to the improved condition of women and the implementation of equality provisions and gender parity in the political process. My understanding is that the MAS was the only party to hold to those gender parity requirements in the last election. And I think this is particularly ironic in light of criticism that's been quoted by some elements of the left centering on issues of women's rights, particularly coming from what I understand is a middle-class urban group of feminist intellectuals called Mujeres Creando. I wonder if you can just briefly address that. Is that right, that the opposition parties, in fact, haven't held to gender parity? And what's your assessment?
None of the opposition parties, the only party that complied with gender parity legislation and gender parity, there's a gender parity law, but also the electoral law and the political parties law all clearly mandate gender parity in candidate. None of them complied. That's a serious offense according to the electoral law. I think there's a lot of criticism on the right and attacking of MAS for not following the Constitution, for not following procedures. But when you sit down and look at it, they haven't followed the rules. Nor does this group feel that the Constitution should apply to them or Bolivian legislation, because we've seen from the very moment that Anya is self-appointed as president to an empty chamber that they feel very strongly that international agreements, national legislation, and the Constitution only apply to their opponents. And that's something that's extremely troubling.
And now maybe with that, if Brett, I'm wondering, because there has been a lot of confusion or disagreement perhaps on the left, first of all, about whether this is a coup, although it seems increasingly impossible to deny that a coup has taken place. And so I think, like, even in Canada here, our mainstream business newspaper, the Globe and Mail, had an editorial a couple of days ago, quite clearly naming it as a coup and a disgrace that the Canadian government and other Western governments were supporting this coup. But I think there's been a history of division or criticism of the MAS and Morales, particularly from influential figures like Pablo Solon. And I wonder if you can give a bit of a backstory on that, particularly around the Tipnis issue, and maybe more recently, the criticisms made around the Potosi mine deal for lithium, and the accuracy of those criticisms or the lack thereof, and what role these have played in the divisions and the impression of divisions abroad.
Sure. Those are important issues. And I will also do want to say a few things about some of the other problems with the MAS political project seen from a left perspective. But to your question, yes. In the beginning, the MAS was, I saw it, people on the ground saw it as a really potentially a revolutionary process of change. They called it the proceso de cambio. And Catherine's already mentioned there was land reform, there was the titling of indigenous lands, clear advances in the redistribution of state goods to people who had long been excluded. Of course, the renegotiation of contracts with gas companies, all of which had a left and relatively revolutionary feel to them. But as early as 2010, 2009, when the development priorities of the state began running up against opposition from some indigenous communities, as in the Tipnis case, many people started getting a bit disenchanted with Evo and the Mas and thought that it was losing its revolutionary content and giving way to a more developmentalist, development at all costs position. And this battle over the Tipnis indigenous territory, which was going to be cross-cut by a new highway, kind of drew attention to that growing contradiction between an indigenous president and his willingness to use the power of the state to impose development projects on indigenous communities. Now, there are other examples of that, but it must be said that there are many indigenous communities, say in southeastern Bolivia, where much of the gas is, that absolutely support the extraction of natural gas, even from their own territories. They do want a piece of the pie, but there's no broad-based opposition to it. And that's a whole other complex area of discussion. But the critique then of folks like Pablo Solon and others from the development perspective is that Evo's government has shifted to the right to deepen the country's dependence on extractive industries, including gas, mining, and even move to expand those activities into protected areas, and even move to weaken indigenous rights protections, to the point that some critics, such as Luis Tapia, a well-known and brilliant philosopher who was once a sort of a backer of the Mas, Luis sort of says that the Mas had turned into a right-wing government, in his words. The other critiques that you mentioned coming from feminist and women's organizations, despite the fact that the Mas has pushed in legal terms to eliminate discrimination, they were not able to radically transform the way of doing politics in Bolivia. And the way of doing politics in Bolivia is usually a bunch of men in a closed room where you don't see a lot of women's voices. And in the case of the Mas, their revolutionary project gave way to some very troubling relationships with the military. And even now in recent years with these, some of the right wing of Santa Cruz, the Mas government made concessions to the big soy growers in attempt to sort of maintain a kind of detente. And our colleague Linda Farthing has written that their revolutionary support, I'm paraphrasing, gave way to a kind of pragmatism to try to stay in power. So that should complicate for listeners this notion that the Mas was somehow a radical vanguard socialist project. It was in some ways, but in many other ways, it was not. And we don't want to hold it up as necessarily something to emulate. And in fact, we should learn from the mistakes for thinking about the future. Definitely, we don't need to try to hide the errors and the problems of the Mas. In fact, we need to use those to think more deeply about what a better revolutionary and transformative project might look like in the future.
Can I add something very quickly? I agree with Brett's assessment completely. This is not all a piece of cake. This is not perfect. This is not the model. And we need to be very realistic about that. I am frustrated in a vision now where we stand with this new government, and I think Brett agrees with me that we needed to get rid of Morales because of the multiple errors he made can justify what's going on in Bolivia now, and that's not the case. It's not justifiable, and we're in a scenario now where Morales is no longer the problem, and we need to look forward. I also wanted to speak a bit about Mujeres Creando and Maria Galindo's statements on the dynamic. She has always been a harsh Morales critic, although the Morales administration passed very progressive legislation and had policies. And I might argue with Brett that there were women in the decision-making processes, that dynamic had changed in the later years of Mas, but that Morales himself was not a feminist. It wasn't a feminist discourse. Many of his comments related to that. And Galindo was very, very critical. I think it's important to note, and with some of her criticisms from Morales, I agreed, and others I disagreed. But I think she's very clearly been able to identify this rightward swing, this disturbing, ultra-conservative, proto-fascist, as Brett said, vision, and understand that and identify it clearly as a coup and the discriminatory measures, and to call them out repeatedly and loudly on this, I think has been a very important contribution.
Yes, I second everything Catherine said, that please don't take my comments as some sort of dismissal of an incredible process of change. I'm just trying to point out some of the critiques, but most definitely the problem now is a right-wing dictatorship.
Thanks, Brett. And maybe actually just following up on the question of the Potosí mine deal, where, as I understand, some of the criticism centered on, first of all, it's a 70-year deal to a small German, relatively small German firm to extract lithium. And there seems to have been criticism from the Potosí region around the lack of royalties specifically allocated to the Potosí region. As I understand it, though, there was going to be money going into the national purse, and the question really was whether more of it should be going specifically to Potosí, and this was the cause for some indigenous groups in that region to turn against Morales. Do I understand that correctly, Brett?
Yeah, and here Catherine might also know more of the details. And so the lithium, and as a lot of people are, you know, saying on Twitter and social media that this was a lithium coup. I don't see any evidence for that. That's way too simplistic. The law that was set up, or there was a decree that set up the lithium extraction company as a national, a government company, much like the government oil and gas company, and the contract for 70 years, which would basically, yes, bring money into the national purse. There were going to be royalties to Potosí. But the way I read that conflict, which came as much from the civic committee, much like the civic committee of Santa Cruz, Potosí has a civic committee of its local small scale and larger medium scale capitalist and organizations. The civic committee wanted more control in the region over the lithium process. Basically, I read it as a radical federalist position, much like the radical federalism you could use to describe Santa Cruz. They want local control over natural resources. And I think that's why you saw this weird alliance between this racist Camacho from the East and this Marcos Pumari, arguably of indigenous descent, from Potosí. I think there had been some back channel work to develop a radical federalist view of how natural resources should be governed and how that wealth should be distributed, which goes against the nationalist view of the MAS that we've seen with gas. And I'd certainly love to hear Catherine's take on that. But I think going forward, we're not really going to see some classical neoliberalism. We're going to see a reworking of a capture of wealth by regional elites, as opposed to what Evo represented was the national control over resource wealth and its national redistribution. I think we're going to see a push to go to a kind of a radical regional federalism. And that's why I think this articulation between the Potosí groups and the right-wing groups of the East happened. But I'd love to hear Catherine's take on that.
Catherine?
Well, I agree with Brett. I think you're looking at a regional civic group. It is fascinating, the discourse of the right and of, for example, the U.S. mainstream press about the management of lithium. It's very interesting that the vice minister, Alberto Echazu, it comes from the Comibol mining ranks. He was he studied in Sweden during his exile in the dictatorships. He has a very strong focus on national policy. At the same time, you know, first there were concerns that Morales' administration wouldn't take advantage or manage the lithium situation correctly. Then there was a concern that there would be no added value, and that was refuted by a whole series of agreements and plans to make batteries and to process other items. And then there was an assumption that there would be the Chinese taking over the industry. And what ended up being a small German company, but in alliance with the German government, a deal that had royalties, that had all of the benefits. But it was another example of how misinformation in these situations and these sectors can cause an uprise. It's very similar to the doctors that opposed the new criminal systems procedures law, although the penalties in the previous law for malpractice were almost double. It's kind of a false information and a popular movement that once they've arrived where they thought they wanted to get, I think they're going to see what Brett's talking about, and that is concentration of wealth, concentration of power, the oligarchy retaking its domination of the Bolivian economy, something that they feel has always been their right. And that, unlike the Morales government, which had a increasing state income and increasing distribution of benefits, we're going to see that a lot of people are going to lose what they need to live day to day as a result of this illegitimate power move.
Thanks, Catherine. I'm wondering, just to build on what Brett was speaking to earlier about maybe some of the lessons that can be learned about the Mas's time in government and perhaps some mistakes that were made. I know one criticism that's been made was a sort of failure of cadre development or development of new leadership. But I'm also wondering, for example, the role that the military and the security forces have played in this coup, what that speaks to about how the Morales government approached reforming these institutions and, you know, what ideologies and continue to prevail within them and what really the demographic makeup of these institutions is, because as I understand it, before the Mas came into government, these were heavily white, non-indigenous institutions. And so is that a sort of reflection of perhaps something that could have been done differently by the Mas government? And maybe, Catherine, if you could speak to that first.
Well, I think it's important to look, you know, Mas clearly made many errors. In terms of strengthening leadership, I think it depends on how you look at it. There is definitely a lot of leadership through state institutions for key membership and key posts for a very representative group of people. There was no, you know, there was always an outcry of people that Evo needs to name a successor. That really doesn't happen in any political scenario. You know, Barack Obama did not name a successor in the United States. We do see the case where Rafael Correa in Ecuador named a successor, and that successor violated all of the precepts that Correa's party had always worked for. So I think to a certain extent, yes, Mas was this pre-electoral coalition during the many elections with often conflicting interests, with diverse sectors that internally kind of battled it out or negotiated government policy. And there were key leaders in that. And it's interesting to note that last year, Morales, and he probably should have done this instead of a fourth run, did identify three successors who are very, you know, very diverse group of people and very skilled. So, you know, turnover in leadership, I think there were at lower levels, it was Evo as the figurehead and the personality that were probably the strength and the weakness of this movement. It's very, very hard to explain. I mean, often, you know, an announcement of a successor leads to attacks on the part of the right wing. It leads to infighting. I don't know what was justified. I'm not sure what would have been better, but we're here where we are. In terms of state involvement, yes, a great deal of upper middle class people who rotated through the ranks in the past, an NGO sector, a very, very well-paid kind of parastate NGO sector that also funneled money, especially a lot of U.S. money after the restrictions to state funding over the International Criminal Court Article 98 agreement. And so this group and this kind of pacted or agreed upon power where ruling sectors kind of moved around the employment and the benefits. You know, people were very much focused on what someone's last name was and what their maternal last name was. And this has changed. And you've got really some educated people, some skilled technicians, some very impressive people doing a lot of impressive things at the state level and at the international level. And I think it's very surprising, although I remember it, to have something that was a relatively smoothly running state apparatus with flaws and hiccups and very, very bureaucratic. You know, it wasn't, as Brett said, it's not that they transformed the state, that it's a completely new kind of state. But there was a functioning system. And I don't see, although this transition government, supposedly transition government, has changed every government official down to vice minister to head to the customs agency, a focus on really reinstating their people. And we see these very old faces, such as the new ambassador to the Organization of American States, Jaime Aparicio, who was Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada's ambassador during the violence and the massacre of Black October. So, you know, this more inclusive nature of the government was also paired with a pretty significant salary decrease for state employees and even presidential salaries. So, you know, to a certain extent, the elites were expelled, but to another certain extent, they weren't willing to work for significantly lower salaries and tighter accounting. And with the new Morales salary decree. And so you have this whole new set of government officials, and it doesn't mean that there were people in place eternally, but now where they do go, where they work, none of that's clear.
Brett, did you want to jump in?
Sure. That's very true. I mean, there's a long tradition in Bolivia of power and the wealth of the state sort of shifting hands back and forth between different sectors of the wider elite. And that was what Evo and the MAS transformed. It pushed those people to the side, not completely excluded, but to the side. And you saw new names, new faces that had long been excluded from the state. I want to go back to your question about the military, though. Very much like Catherine characterized Evo's, you know, personal characteristics and his charisma as being both a strength and a weakness, I think the military is also the Achilles heel of projects like the MAS project. Evo, certainly, the MAS, when they came in, they did what's called, they retired several promotions of military generals. And what that means is the military officer class comes out of a military training school system, and your promotion is sort of your class, your cohort. And they move up together in the ranks, and they have a lot of cohesion between them, social cohesion. And as you move up through the ranks with your cohort, gain more and more power, of course. And so the MAS did retire, I think, two or three cohorts and said, nope, you're not going to be the generals. The next one, you're not going to be the generals, to try to get down to younger groups that weren't so entrenched in the very old guard national security mentality of the military. Evo also promoted ways for indigenous peoples or people of color to move up into the officer ranks more easily, because historically the recruits, the non-commissioned officers on down, were mostly people of color, and the officers class, the higher up you went, the wider it got. And so that racial apartheid was built into the military, and Evo certainly worked to transform that. And I think that was part of the reason he had significant loyalty in the military for most of his time. Now, the question becomes, do you really need a military in a country like Bolivia that has also is taking a good chunk of state wealth? That's something that we could debate, but it's there. And Evo tried to make it part of the process of change in the ways I described. It also incorporated the military and the redistribution of a state transfer called the Juancito Pinto bonus. So every year, military officers would go to distribute a one-time payment to school children, which was part of this wider redistributive policy agenda. Evo tried to transform the military from a national security paradigm to a more anti-imperialist paradigm by creating a school of anti-imperialist training. They changed the slogan of the army to borrow that of Venezuela and other revolutionary speaking places to Patria o muerte venceremos, meaning, you know, fatherland or death, we will conquer. Evo also made overtures and set up commemorations of Che Guevara, who was killed by the Bolivian military in 1967 with the help of the CIA. And those were symbolic moves that many people on the left applauded. But the reality is that many people in the military were still part of that old national security paradigm. And for example, I heard, you know, in my own ears, way out in southeastern Bolivia, well into the Evo Morales administration, I saw a military commemoration, and the officer speaking was talking about Che Guevara as a criminal and an assassin, and as his killing a great victory. And this is during Evo's government. So another friend recounted to me a time when Hugo Chavez came to visit before his death, and he shouted the slogan in front of the military officers, and they didn't repeat it because at the end of the day, their sort of nationalist pride is stronger than their anti-imperialist convictions, I think. So I don't have enough more inside knowledge about what might have gone on behind the scenes leading up to the military telling Evo he should resign. Maybe Catherine knows a bit more about different factions, but thinking historically, the military has always been politically fickle. Its main interest is in defending itself. Historically, we've seen in the 60s and 70s a right-wing coup coming from the military, and less than a year later, a left-wing coup coming from within the military. So it's a complex organization that switches quickly when it can see that its interest might be better served by realigning it with another force. And I think that's what we saw with the coup, and I think that's what we're seeing now, is that the military has said, okay, well, now we're going to have our bread buttered working with these folks. I'd love to hear if Catherine has any other insight there.
I agree with what Brett said. I think there are a couple other things that I would add to that, and that is that traditional patterns since the return to democracy, I think part of it is that you have a very young group of military officers that had not participated. You know, starting last year, the people who were lower ranking or enlisted people who participated in the dictatorship have probably all retired now. You have a younger cadre of young officers, and they don't remember the pushback, for example, for human rights violations in Black October. It's important to note that the military high command all got prison sentences for the massacre in 2003. It's also important to note that Mesa, the second place candidate, and a lot of people backing this coup from the MNR party fled the country, or Mesa testified against the military and they avoided prosecution. So the dynamic of repression and then blame on the military is something that the armed forces believed they could avoid with the supreme decree passed by Áñez. But it's important to note that the outcry from international human rights organizations and the Inter-American Human Rights Commission saying that the decree cannot excuse crimes against humanity is something that the armed forces hadn't taken into account. Also, the armed forces have been, by some groups, prized in their discourse, but very rarely have they benefited economically. And I think this goes back to Brett's comment about the armed forces being in it for the armed forces as much as they have under the Morales administration, with significant salary increases, with 100% retirement, with the purchase of new aircraft, new equipment. You know, this is one of the reasons where we could very easily identify the helicopters used in the Sacaba massacre, because there were new helicopters that the Morales administration had purchased. We knew it wasn't the old Hueys that existed before Morales' tenure. So they have a lot of equipment, they have improved self-esteem, they have solid benefits, and they have a right that's promising them a lot of things. That the right will be able to follow through with those, that they will not face long-term legal consequences internationally for the excessive use of force and for the deaths, is something that I think they haven't planned well for in the future. And I think really what pushed this over the line was initially the police rebellion. The police rebellion that occurred 3 days before the suggestion on the part of the armed forces breakdown, I would say, was more decisive. And I think the police decision to rebel was not so much anti-Morales as it was economic, and that they perceived this situation as an ability to jockey for equal salaries and equal benefits as the armed forces. They were very, very angry that they were out on the streets and that the Morales administration had not called the armed forces out. I think that was the Morales decision, which correctly identified the presence of the armed forces with bullet wounds and death. And it seems that what happened when they pulled back is that the other side offered them something that they wanted very badly, and that was regain control over the very profitable ID card and driver's license business. In the past, that had been a main source of income for the armed forces. And I think although they received money from the government, although the government had taken away from them, it's really important to highlight a great source of corruption income. And they wanted that back. You know, the police were not acting on principle, they were acting on pocketbook. And I think that you see them very zealously repressing the population. And in many cases for the rank and file, although Brett aptly pointed out that there are now more diverse members in the officer classes, you have low income people from indigenous background shooting at low-income people from indigenous background. And as in the case, there are cases where there are family members on both sides. This is something that it will be difficult to keep up, and very difficult to perceive that a right-wing government interested in accumulation of wealth is actually going to strengthen either one of those sectors.
Thank you, Catherine. That's great. And since we're almost out of time, I wonder if we can close by maybe turning to the question of what those of us who are outside of Bolivia can most usefully do in this context. Where can pressure be exerted? What type of support or solidarity is most useful to those who are resisting this coup? First, Catherine, and then Brett.
Well, probably Brett will have a better idea because he is outside Bolivia. But I think it's important to hold the current government accountable for the extreme violence, to highlight that they are not constitutional, that they are not behaving constitutionally, to pressure for elections, but elections that are inclusive and in level playing field, and for a mechanism developed of how we can actually verify that, because it becomes very, very clear that OAS as an arbiter isn't transparent or productive, nor does it resolve any conflicts. We need to push for more international funding for the Human Rights Ombudsman Office and careful oversight, because the person there is interim and doing a good job, of how another person will be chosen in the Bolivian Congress. Strength for a rebuilding of the Bolivian human rights community. I don't think that Morales dismantled that, but a portion of the people significant became part of the administration, and another portion became disaffected. But what we see right now is a real shortage of human rights documentation. We need visits and delegation by international human rights monitors. We need the presence of international journalists. We need international pressure to respect freedom of the press, basic human rights. The list goes on and on.
Yes, I don't think I have too much to add. I think what we need to be on the lookout for is an attempt by, specifically from the case of the United States, an attempt to restore an older model, or you might call it the Colombia model. Catherine knows much more about this than I do. An older model of war on drugs mentality as our main foreign policy relationship with Bolivia, which included the presence of the DEA and the FBI in Bolivia. It included our training of troops to repress coca growers as an argument that that would somehow stop cocaine consumption in the United States, all of which led to human rights violations and violence. I also think we need to be attentive to the risk that what happens in Ecuador is going to happen in Bolivia, which is the restoration of dependence on institutions like the IMF and the restoration of interventions by development agencies like USAID, which are certainly going to want to reestablish the American influence in the country through those familiar mechanisms that Evo and the MAS freed the country from, especially domination by the IMF. And that's of course not happening at this moment. I think what Catherine's saying is very important for this moment, and that is to draw attention to the fact that this is a de facto regime carrying out violence and trying to basically purge the Hamas from the political system, which is basically an attempt to take away the rights of at least 50% of the population by destroying a political party that, despite its many flaws, has great popular support. So I think certainly focusing right now on what's happening on the ground, drawing attention to it like you yourself are doing with these kinds of podcasts, and paying attention to Bolivia once the 15-minute or attention span turns somewhere else, because I think we're going to see a lot of low-level violence, very less visible violences, not necessarily in the streets, but reprisals, vendettas against activists in the local area. My friends sort of shut down their social media out of fear. So I think we need to be very attentive to that as well.
Thanks to both of you. This has been an extremely useful overview and look at what's happening there. And we're going to continue to follow developments in Bolivia closely, well beyond the 15-minute attention span of the mainstream media. So if we can, maybe we will check in with you later if both of you are available for that.
That'd be wonderful.
And stay safe, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Wait, before you turn us off, I just want to say the same thing to Catherine. Take care, Catherine, and I will see you on Twitter.
Yep, that will be lovely. I can't believe I didn't think of the drug stuff. That's so my thing.
Well, I learned it from you, so keep it up. Okay.
Well, yeah, nice to talk to you both.
You too. Un abrazo. And then thanks to you, Corbin.
Thank you. Thanks, both of you.
Cheers.
Okay, take care.
I want to thank both Catherine and Brett for their time. You can follow Catherine's work on Twitter, where she writes under @AndeanInfoNet, while Brett is @BrettGustafson. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.